Donate and listen to the podcast at WRWL.org.
All right, we are back, and we're going to take a look as we go back into actual history and again the diary of William Bradford.
Can I add something before you start back? Remember how lately the left has gone after Columbus Day. We got to get rid of Columbus Day. And they're going after things. Well, now they're going after Thanksgiving. There's a article that was put out in the Wall Street Journal, and it's kind of one of those, we've got to get rid of this Thanksgiving, thanking God. And they had a piece out there censoring the pilgrims, and it's talking about how they've run editorials for a long time, and now the left is trying to censor anything about Thanksgiving and the holiday, and they want to, you know, like with Christian, we've got to make it secular. It can't be a religious thing. It could be a secular festival, but we've got to get God out. So this is a real battle, and we're seeing it happen in front of us right now today all across America.
Well, you know, us older folks that still hold to the faith, we really, really have to stand fast. And now we have done that all of these years. We've never backed up. We've never stood down. And again, and we begged people and begged people and begged people not to place their children in the public school system. Now they're reaping what they sowed. And again, I know I've mentioned it many times, how many times I've had women call me and wish that they had listened and not allowed their children to go to public universities where they lost all of their faith. But anyhow, so God has raised us up for such a time as this, and we're going to run to this battle, and we're going to fight the fight. And you know that. The good Lord told us that when he comes back, he's bringing the victory with him. So we don't have to worry about the victory. He's going to supply that. We have to do is we got to go out and get the job done. Do what he has raised us up to do. He has told us to be doers of the word, not hearers only, deceiving yourself. And there's too many hearers only out there filling the pews of entertainment centers called churches that are hearers only and not doers of the word. And I'm going to tell you, folks, those of you that are listening to me, you'll regret that. You'll regret that. It's time right now. You have an opportunity. This is the time right now. God has calling you to stand up. First of all, the very first thing you need to do is make your salvation sure. Make your salvation sure. And then run to this battle. If you are saved, there's going to be some fight in you. And get out and get her done. And I'm going to pick it up where we left off as we go through this here on William Bradford's diary. The major differences in the conditions were that the lands and the houses could not be divided up until the seventh year, and that out of a week of 7 days, 2 days would no longer be used for a person's own employment and profit. Also, the patent granted them was not for New England as hoped for, but for the Northern Virginia land. These conditions would have a major effect on the success or the failure of the colony. After great length, a small ship, the Speedwell, was purchased and fitted in Holland, and it was planned that it would be used in the new colony for fishing. All was made ready for the journey. Another ship, the Mayflower, was hired at London. All seemed finally ready. Everyone gathered at Plymouth, England, and awaited departure. The day before leaving, the Separatists held a day of solemn prayer. The pastor read from the Bible from Ezra 8:21, which says, "And there at the river Pahava, I proclaimed a fast, that we might humble ourselves before our God and seek of him a right way for us and for our children and for all of our substance. Everything being ready, each family took to the proper ship and sails lifted high. The journey of the Separatists to America had finally begun on August 5th, 1620. 102 men, women, and children had begun the great adventure." At this point in the story, it should be noted that the smaller of the two ships, the Speedwell, became unseaworthy. Twice the Separatists had to return to England and leave again. Finally, the Speedwell was sold. Some people gave up. The rest were loaded on the larger ship, the Mayflower. This accounts for their late arrival at Cape Cod during the winter months. The Separatists, now called Pilgrims, had finally left England on their voyage to America. Their journey was great for a while. Fair winds and weather were enjoyed by all for a short season, wrote Bradford. Then halfway across, they began to encounter strong winds and fearsome storms. And the ship was severely shaken. The upper decks became very leaky. One of the main masts bowed and cracked. Everyone feared that the ship would not be able to finish the journey. A few of the pilgrims realized that the mariners were even afraid and could tell from their talk that they wanted to turn back. They went to the officers of the ship to discuss the situation. There was much discussion and difference of opinion as to what to do. After considerable talk, it was decided the ship was strong enough. The main mast was fixed by using a huge screw, which one of the pilgrims had brought with him from Holland. The large iron screw from a printing press was used to hold the mast in place. They caulked what they could in the upper decks. With that, they committed themselves to the will of God and resolved to proceed. And after a period of time and more storms, they finally reached Cape Cod. Now, it's interesting at this point to ponder the fixing of the ship's mast. Imagine for a moment a family packing their things in Holland. They couldn't take much, only what was truly needed. The father runs over and puts in a huge screw. One can just picture the discussion as to its true value. It was divine providence which saw to it that the screw was on board the Mayflower. Bradford writes at this point about the people. They had borne such hardships even before the journey. The trip at sea had been miserable. Now they looked at a land where there were no inns to welcome them, no friends to help them to get settled, and no places to refresh themselves. The apostles, according to the Bible, when they were shipwrecked, were met by the natives with kindness and mercy. The natives that awaited on shore for the pilgrims were ready to meet them with bows and arrows. Not only that, but it was now winter. If you've ever lived in a part of the country, you know what the winters are cold and harsh. Fierce storms are common. It was dangerous to travel, much less explore an unknown seacoast. What the people saw from the ship was the vast wilderness full of wild animals and men. Behind them stood the vast Atlantic Ocean, which they had just crossed. It stood between them and the rest of civilized world. The ship's officers and crew were growing restless. There was talk of just dropping the pilgrims and their things off at any shore. The pilgrims looked back on all that had happened and all they had left behind. The hope which seemed so big and bright back in Leyden now seemed so small. All that was left was the grace of God to sustain them. Bradford wrote of how they wondered if their children and grandchildren might say, "Our fathers were Englishmen, which came over this great ocean and were ready to perish in this wilderness. But they cried unto the Lord, and he heard their voice and looked upon their adversities. He delivered them from the hands of the oppressor. Let them confess before the Lord his loving kindness and his wonderful works before the sons of men." The pilgrims had arrived at Cape Cod on November 11th. They had to find a place to live quickly. The storms which they had met during their voyage had carried the ship much farther north than had been planned. The land they looked upon was part of the New England not Northern Virginia, which they had their charter. There was talk among the pilgrims and the seamen of how they would take their own liberties once on land, since there was no law. At that time, 41 of the pilgrims banded together to write the Mayflower Compact. Let's take a moment and read what it says. Well, before we read the Mayflower Compact, just think about this. How would you feel? You're there. Now, you've got these, amongst them, you've got a lot of these sailors that came. A lot of them weren't sailors. They were mostly all single men. And here, the pilgrims had their wives. And these guys were looking. They'd been at sea all this time, hadn't been with women. Not only that, but there was scarcely enough food to get by, okay? And what a voyage it is. You know, on those ships, they didn't have bathrooms.
That's right.
And so what you'd have to do is they went and they would kind of have like a little outhouse at the end of the ship, over the edge of the ship. And it was especially inconvenient for the ladies, wasn't it?
Right.
For the Christian ladies. And so there were a lot of hardships there on that ship. And, you know, often too, the pilgrim men, the Christian men, would not be happy about some of the language being used. Today in America, you know, that language is used by the young women, okay? It's gotten pretty bad. And so we're going to take a look at now the signing of the Mayflower Compact. Do you want to comment on that, Joe, before we go there? Are you there, Joe? Did we lose Joe?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
For some reason there, just nothing happened. Have people remember it starts off in the name of God, amen, and it is actually a covenant between them and God. It was the first political body that announced they would be governing according to God and his law and established a precedence that was followed for several hundred years in this country.
And with that, I'm going to go ahead and read the Mayflower Compact. In the name of God, amen, we whose names are underwritten, the loyal subjects of our dread sovereign Lord King James, by the grace of God of Great Britain, France, and Ireland, King Defender of the Faith, having undertaken for the glory of God and advancement of the Christian faith, the honor of our king and country, a voyage to plant the first colony in the northern parts of Virginia, do by these present solemnly and mutually in the presence of God and of one another, covet and combine ourselves together unto a civil body politic. For our better ordering and preservation and furtherance of the ends before said, and by virtue hereof to enact, constitute, and frame such just and equal laws, ordinances, and acts, constitutions, and offices from time to time as shall be thought most meet and convenient for the general good of the colony, unto which we promise all due submission and obedience. In witness whereof, we have hereunder subscribed our names at Cape Cod, the 11th of November in the year and the reign of the sovereign Lord King James of England, France, and Ireland, the 18th, and of Scotland, the 54th, 1620. So there you go. That was the Mayflower Compact. Now,
well, you think when the founders, just a little while later, if you look at what they said, Sam Adams, the father of the Revolution, as the Declaration of Independence was signed, he proclaimed or declared, "This day we have restored the sovereign to whom all men ought to be obedient. He reigns in heaven, and from the rising to the setting of the sun, let his kingdom come." Now, you know, they talk about they're trying this revisionist history. They don't teach this kind of thing. This country was set as a Christian nation. All our people, John Jay, the first Chief Justice of the court, Supreme Court, Providence, God has given to our people the choice of their rulers. It is the duty as well as the privilege and interest of our Christian nation to select and prefer Christians for their rulers. I've got pages of this stuff that's no longer taught. No wonder the president comes out and says, we are no longer a Christian nation. We're a secular nation. This is Barack Obama. Because when you take God out of history, you're rewriting the entire history of this nation. You cannot take God out of the Constitution founding fathers without just destroying everything.
Well, if you remember what Barack Obama said, that we were actually more of a Muslim nation, an Islamic nation, than we were Christian.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, well, the thing of it is we have to, you know, there's, look at it this way, though. If those of us who have been holding on and have been fighting back, if we had been like so many others that said, well, let somebody else, I'm too busy to worry about this, and, just go ahead about their business looking for the American dream and not paying attention and not standing up and not fighting back. And that's what's happened over the years. And now they're starting to realize, Joe, that, hey, you know what? We could lose all of our freedoms. This communism thing is getting very close, and it's getting very real. And so now we're starting to see some awakening, but they've got to be much more aggressive than they are right now. It's got to be much more aggressive because the opposition is going to be more aggressive, aren't they?
Oh, they already are. Just one quick article for Thanksgiving. There's an article in The Atlantic. This Wednesday, urging readers to use Thanksgiving as an opportunity to deprogram their conservative relatives. According to Molly Jong Fast, maybe you'll plant the seed, sow just a little doubt or whatever Tucker Carlson is saying now, or maybe you'll need to report a relative to the FBI. Yeah, she went on and, you know, talks about how Thanksgiving is a disappointing day, doesn't live up to the fantasy, and she said the best Thanksgiving she ever spent was the one in rehab when she was 19. She went on just talking, it's sick stuff like that, and basically she said, well, you've got family members that follow QAnon and need to be educated at Thanksgiving about the COVID vax, the safety and the authenticity of the 2020 election. I've done 43 Thanksgivings in my life. I'm here to tell you, Thanksgiving is terrible. And if you at least spend the time trying to deprogram your relatives, you won't be bored or depressed this Thanksgiving. This is the Antichrist system, folks. This is what we are up against. It is real. It is Antichrist. They hate God. They hate our faith. They hate us because we will hold on to our Christ, and this is a real revolution. It's a communist revolution in America. You're not listening to history. You are living in it. You are watching it happen daily.
Well, I just read this week from the Rockefeller plan that they had made. We had read years ago.
Yeah.
Talked about the different ways of dividing and conquering the country. And, of course, they went into, we will have a pandemic. And they actually described this COVID-19. It's not going to be that very severe, but we're going to induce such fear into the people that they will be taking these, what they call the vaccines. And those that have been vaxxed will be divided against the unvaxxed. Well, first of all, it's not a vaccine; it's a bioweapon.
Right.
And I got a call from today from a lady who told me she was kind of upset. And I was talking to her; she's a very close friend. And unfortunately, she hadn't been listening to the radio program, and she had gone out and got the bioweapon shot. I would call it the kill shot. And anyhow, she was telling me how she was kind of upset because they normally have Thanksgiving dinner, and some of the people that would normally come aren't coming because, you know, they had taken the kill shots themselves, but there were the grandchildren, the five-year-olds, had not taken the shot. And this lady told me that she didn't want a five-year-old. I said, do not listen to me. Do not allow that child to take the kill shots, okay?
Yes. And they don't get the virus. More children die of the flu and the colds than they do from COVID. They don't carry it. They don't pass it on. The death rate in children is like 0.0005. It's almost non-existent, except if you have a child that's extremely ill with other factors, very bad other factors. It's just one big lie that they have put out there. But most of the doctors around the world that really are for the people, for their patients, are saying, no, children don't need it. Don't give it.
Well, not just that, Joe, but what we've been saying for a long time now is coming to pass. We know they're even in England, which is virtually a socialist country, is now they are admitting that twice as many people are dying from the vax, or from this what they call COVID, twice as many of those that are vaxxed, we don't want to call it vaxxed, who have taken the kill shots are dying more than 2-1 over those that have not taken the kill shot by the COVID.
And that's in adults.
Yeah. And again, like you said,
they're figuring out don't give it to the children. I mean, you know, they were slow to catch on, but even now they're starting to come around and say, you know, the children don't need it. It's too dangerous.
Well, not only that, Joe, but even a lot of us older folks, you know, who had gotten the COVID, we had gotten it and we survived it. Because we built up our immune system. And I survived it without taking any ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine, just by taking the zinc and the vitamin C, so on and so forth, and building up the system. But others weren't, you know. If you have other things, it's not going to hit everybody the same. And there's different variants of it. But let me tell you, I would rather get the COVID any day than the poison, than the kill shot. But
well,
let me.
They also are not telling people that once you have natural immunity, very few people with natural immunity are getting sick, and we're not the ones that are passing on the COVID.
Nope. We got to get back to the Plymouth Plantation.
Right.
The 41 Pilgrims signed the compact and then elected Mr. John Carver as their governor for that year. Work then proceeded on the storehouse and small cottages to live in. Laws were made as the need arose for their protection, both in the civil and military governments. Work on the town, which they called Plymouth, went slowly as the winter storms raged. The following months were hard and difficult times. Discontent would at times break out, but was handled with wisdom and patience by the governor. The saddest part of that first winter was that in those first 2 to 3 months, one half of their members died. It was especially bad in January and February, which were the worst of the winter months. Housing was still not good. The people and sailors became infected with scurvy and other diseases which had been brought on by the long, hard sea voyage. During those months, 2 or 3 people would die each day. Over 100 died in all. At the end of the winter, there were barely 50 pilgrims remaining. Of those remaining, there were only 6 or 7 that were of sound health. These few spent all their time and energy fetching wood for fires and taking care of the sick. 2 men worked the hardest. They were Mr. William Brewster and their reverend elder, and Miles Standish, their military commander. Their health was so good the entire time that they never were sick. These 2 men God saw fit to guard. Those who were well would give of themselves unselfishly to help others. Bradford wrote that he did not doubt that their rewards awaited in heaven for them. During those first months, the winter, the Indians would often come by the camp and watch, but when approached, would run away. Once they even stole the pilgrims' tools while the pilgrims had gone to dinner. At about the 16th of March, a certain Indian came boldly against them. He spoke in broken English, which the pilgrims could understand and marveled at. The Indian told of how he was a part of the country, but of an eastern part. English ships had come to fish. The English had taught him to speak English, and in return he taught them about the area and about the Indians living there. His name was Samosat. Samosat also spoke of another Indian named Squanto, who was a native of the Plymouth area, but had been taken to England for a while and could speak better English. The pilgrims and Samosat talked and entertained each other for a while, and then he left. A while later, he returned with five other Indians and the tools which had been stolen. Samosat said they were making the way for their sachem chief called Masiat. I don't know if I can pronounce that right. Massasoit.
Massasoit.
Massasoit. About 4 or 5 days later, their chief arrived with other Indians and one named Squanto. The pilgrims and the Indian chief made peace with each other and established the following treaty. Neither the Indians nor the pilgrims were to hurt or injure the other. If someone did hurt one of the other, then the offender would be sent to the other for punishment. If anything was stolen from either side, it had to be returned. If anyone would unjustly make war on the other, then they would help each other. They would let the other tribes in the area and the new arriving settlers know about these terms so peace could be kept. When they visited each other, all weapons would be left behind. Spring was now approaching. The sick were growing better. The dying had stopped. The pilgrims had gone through much with patience and contentedness. They were truly upheld by the hand of God. In the beginning of April, the Mayflower was finally sent back to England. The mariners had built lodgings for the winter. They were happy to finally be on their way home. Time had arrived for planting. This was the first spring. All who were able to begin to plant corn, Squanto was there to show them how, and it was of much help. Squanto showed them how to plant a fish with each seed, or else the corn would not grow. The fish provided moisture and helped to fertilize the seed. He also showed them how to store winter, to store water, and how to tend the corn. The British seeds, which the pilgrims had brought with them, did not grow because they had gone bad during the sea voyage. On September 18th, a small boat was sent out in the bay to explore the area. There were tales of an eastern people who would raid the villages and steal the corn and kill the people. They returned safely with plenty of beaver. The men were sorry that the town had not been built on the other side, but God assigns the boundaries of each man's habitations. God had different plans for the other areas. The pilgrims found the Lord to be with them in all that they did. Bradford praised his name forever to all posterity. The seasons were getting on. The pilgrims began to gather in their small harvest and get ready for the winter. And many set about fishing and brought in cod and bass and other fish. There had been no want all summer. Now they would have to store much so there would be no want during the long winter. Winter fowl and wild turkeys and venison and other foods were stored away. The storehouse was filled when they were done. Many wrote home to England about all the food they had. November 16, 21. arrived, and with it a small ship, which was not expected. Mr. Cushman and 35 other pilgrims arrived. Concern arose about having enough food for the winter as the newcomers arrived without provisions. The new arrivals were welcomed happily, but it was wished that they had at least brought clothes or beds or pots to cook with. When the new arrivals came, a letter from Mr. Weston in England. He was upset on how long the Mayflower had been kept, and before its return, the fact that the ship did not return full of things to sell, and many other complaints. The second ship, called the Fortune, was quickly dispatched with a full cargo of clapboard and beaver skins for England. Mr. Cushman returned with a ship to inform Mr. Weston of all that was going on in the colony. There were more pilgrims now waiting and laden to come to England, and Mr. Weston had promised to provide transportation for all who wanted to come. After the ship left, the newcomers were placed with the existing families. An account of the provisions was taken. It was discovered that if they gave everyone half of what they had anticipated, the food would last only 6 months. They found it hard to be able to eat only half of what they had planned, but did so with the hope of more supplies reaching them. In May of 1622, with food almost completely gone, the pilgrims spotted a small ship in the bay. It arrived from Mr. Weston with 7 more pilgrims, but no provisions. Mr. Weston's other ships were a short distance away, fishing, but would not venture to Cape Cod. Everyone was by then hungry. They were reminded of Psalm 118:8. It is better to trust in the Lord than to have confidence in man. Mr. Weston was happy to send more pilgrims, but always seemed to forget to send more food. The pilgrims, now in desperation, turned to God and the Bible for comfort. All their hopes for help from Mr. Weston were gone. All his promises of providing for them were empty words. Many became very bitter in spirit about their plight. Shortly thereafter, Mr. Weston again sent a ship with 60 more men to the colonies. These men would eventually go to the Massachusetts Bay. But for a while, they were placed with the pilgrims. Many were sick and had to be taken care of. Food was running out. These newcomers were an unruly bunch. Bradford and the others became fearful of what would happen to the colony. The 60 men finally left for Massachusetts Bay, but famine was growing each day. Just when all seemed lost, the Lord, who never fails, provided again. A small ship was sighted. The ship was from Virginia. The captain spared all that he could and told his men to do the same. The pilgrims received not only food, but knowledge of the area in relation to Virginia. The food, when divided for so many, did not amount to much, but God blessed it, and it was enough to keep them until harvest. The harvest, which now was ripe, was too small and was not enough for the whole year. The people were not accustomed to growing Indian corn. Many could not work hard due to starving. Part of the harvest was stolen before it could ripen by starving people. It looked as though the next year would be another one of famine, and unless something happened. Now, once again, by God's providence, a ship arrived. It had been sent to explore all the harbors between Virginia and Cape Cod. It was well stocked with English beads and knives, which were good for trading with the Indians. The pilgrims traded beaver skins for these items and hoped for trading with the Indians for corn. About this time, the men whom Mr. Weston had settled in Massachusetts Bay began to run short on supplies. They began to wonder what would happen to them. Bradford wondered at how quickly they were in need of supplies, as they had been completely supplied by ship. They soon starved and began to die. The ones who lived would brag of how strong they were. The pilgrims knew the truth. It is God who can make the weak to stand and the strong to fall. Now at Plymouth, no supplies were heard of, nor did they expect any. The leader set about trying to think of a way to grow more corn before winter to keep everyone from starving. After much discussion, the governor, William Bradford, now as Mr. Carver had died, suggested the answer. Each family was given a plot of ground and corn to plant. It would become the responsibility for each family to grow their own food. The results were amazing. The children were busy planting. Women happily went into the fields to work. Even the weak and the young became involved in the production of food. This resulted in more corn being produced than the colony would have the other way, that is. And this was the start of individual farming, which replaced collective farming or socialism, which did not work. The wise men of old had long believed that if all the people were brought into a society where they all shared everything, no matter what they did, then the people would be happy and prosperous. What Bradford found using the idea at Plymouth was that the people were confused, discontented, and did not want to work. The young men who were strong did not want to work hard for other men's wives and children without extra pay. The person was sick and could not work was thought to be wrong to want food and clothing which he did not help to grow or to make. The wives did not want to do the work for other men, like washing their clothes and fixing their meals. Many thought that this had been a form of slavery. Bradford saw in the people a corruption which they could not help. God in his wisdom saw another course for them to take. As each day ended in this new adventure, every family would not know if there would be food the next day. Prayers were raised on a high. A new meaning of the words became known. Give us our daily bread. The new method of producing food was met with patience and a hearty spirit which lasted for the most part of the next 2 years. And so here, as we take a look at this here, by this time, there was only one good fishing boat left. They divided up the groups to take turns of fishing with nets. No sooner was the boat emptied of its cargo than another group took her part out. Each group would not come home until they had caught something, for they knew that there was nothing at home. If they were to return with nothing, it would be of great discouragement to the rest. And when the fishing was hard and all the people would hunt for shellfish which could be caught during the low tide, they would also hunt for groundnuts and fowl. At this point, Bradford told about the trials of farming. It seems that people worked long and hard, but that large crops just did not seem to appear. The Lord sent a drought which lasted from the third week in May until the middle of July. There was no rain, only a great heat. The corn began to wither away in spite of the fact that it had been planted with fish for moisture. It was at this point that a day of prayer was set aside for the entire colony. The next day was clear and hot, not a cloud in the sky. But towards evening, the sky became overcast, and it began to rain. The rain did not pour down, which would have just washed out all the plants, but it came down in a gentle sweet mist, just the right amount, and not too much or too hard. The rains came with no wind or thunder. The rains quickly revived the corn and other fruit trees. The Indians marveled at the blessing of the rain, and God then sent seasonal rains until it was time for the harvest. Through the rains and the warm weather which God provided, the harvest was the largest they had ever had. There was much rejoicing in the colony to thank God for all that he had done. They set aside one day in the day of thanksgiving to God for delivering them. Thus, in 1623, the first Thanksgiving Day was held to praise God. Next Thanksgiving Day, as we sit down to the table full of turkey and vegetables, rolls and such, we need to remember, and that's tomorrow.
That's right.
Yeah.
1623. It was in that year that God delivered the pilgrims out of the famine. About 14 days later, the ship called Anna arrived, and Mr. William Pierce was the captain. With him were 60 more people for the colony. Some were wives and children of men already at the colony. Some became very useful due to their skills. There were also some who were not pilgrims, but who the Virginia Company had said could own their own land, but were to remain under the government of the colony. These people were to cause problems later on. The newcomers to the colony were not prepared for what they found. Many wished they were back in England. Others fell to the ground weeping. All were full of sadness. Their friends, however, rejoiced to see their old friends. The conditions did not bother them now. They looked forward to better days with friends and around them. The pilgrims welcomed the newcomers with a dinner of lobster and fish. Food was still tight, so water was the only other thing that they could offer. God, however, gave them strength and health so that they would know that Deuteronomy 8:3 was right. Man lives not by bread alone, but by every word that comes out of the mouth of God. The planters, now that the corn was ripe, were afraid that their corn would be given to the newcomers, who had brought some provisions, but not enough to make it through the year until the next harvest. Bradford, as governor, decided that the planters were to keep their food and the newcomers were to keep their provisions. If either ran out, they could purchase food from the other. This seemed to please everyone. The ship Anne was soon laden with clapboard to be taken back to England. Beaver and other skins were also sent back. Mr. Winslow also returned to England to report to the company and purchase things that the colony might need. By now, it was time for the colony to hold its yearly elections, and the number of people had grown considerably. Bradford wanted more assistance to the governor, elected to help them with all the problems which were coming up. The people elected 5 people as assistants to help the governor. As spring arrived again, the colonists found that they did not starve. The good harvest they had reaped through their individual efforts had worked. They set about now with renewed energy. Each family worked hard on their land. Corn became prized more highly than silver. Those with extra corn would use it as trade amongst themselves. If someone had money, he found that the corn was the preferred trade. Such a good harvest was important for many reasons, not the least of these, barter. The people now approached the governor with a request. Up to this point, the land which was farmed one year was given to another the next. Now they requested that the same land be allowed to be worked each year. That way a person could reap the benefits of fertilizing and hard work done the year before instead of having another profit. This was agreed on, and each person was given an acre of land near the town to farm until the 7 years were up. By keeping the farm small and close together, safety and defense was improved. Now, there were many other adventures which the pilgrims had. They went through many trials and hardships, but they always were steadfast and kept their faith in God. At the end of the diary, Bradford told about the spirit of the people in the new land. With the growth of more people in New England, many came and many types of wickedness. He arrived and he marveled at its growth, since if any wickedness was found, it was severely punished. The punishments could not bring an end to many different sins. It caused him to wonder that and to fear at the consideration of the corrupt nature of man. In this place, where so many of God's miracles were shown, it still grew. He considered that possibly the devil carried a greater spirit against the churches of Christ and those spreading the gospel. Bradford demanded to know just how so many wicked and profane people should so quickly come over to the new land and mix with God's people. He remembered that the main reason for the settling of the land had been for freedom of religion. Bradford then attempted to answer his own question. First, it had to be remembered that whenever Jesus sows good seed, envious men try to sow bad. Second, the labor was so great to start a new life with the building of so much and doing without so much, that the idea of just taking what someone else had already built became great. Third, in the rush to bring the godly people to the new land, some began to make a trade of it and did not care who they had brought over. Thus, many unworthy people arrived here. Fourth, God blessed his people both inwardly and outwardly. Knowing this, many people like to follow God's people to reap the benefit, just as people followed Christ around so that they might eat of the loaves of bread. The same reason that when the Israelites left Egypt, there were many who went along just to be out of Egypt. Thus, in 20 years' time, Bradford wondered if the good parts might also be going bad. In the concluding parts of this section of Bradford's history, which we have been studying, Bradford talks again of the pilgrims. Bradford admired the great providence of God in spite of the many changes and hardships which the people went through, even with the many difficulties they had to meet. God brought many of them to a ripe old age. Many of them reached the ages of 60, 65, 70. Some even lived until 80 years old, as Bradford did. It seemed extraordinary that it should be so, since famine, unwholesome food, drinking a lot of water, sorrows, troubles, and such were thought to be the enemies of old age. Yet all of these things and more did the pilgrims partake. They went from England to Holland, which had worse air. They were inspired to speak in the hull of a ship for weeks on end and think of all the trials they'd suffered upon their arrival in New England. As with the apostles in 2 Corinthians 11:26 and 27, they were often journeyed in the perils of winter, of water, and the perils of robbers, and the perils of their own nation, and perils among the heathen, and perils of the wilderness, and perils of the sea, and perils among false brothers, and weariness and painfulness, and watching often, and hunger and thirst, fasting, and often in cold and nakedness. What was it that upheld them? It was the visitation from God which upheld them, says Bradford. And Job 10:12 says, "You have given me life and grace, and your visitations has preserved my spirit." The God who upheld the apostles upheld them too, and they were persecuted but not forsaken, cast down but did not perish. 2 Corinthians 4:9 says, "As unknown and yet known, as dying, and behold, we live as chastened and yet are not killed." 2 Corinthians 6:9, God, it seems, would have all men to behold and observe such mercies and works of his providence. As these are towards his people, that they, in like cases, might be encouraged to depend upon God in their trials and also bless them. His name when he see his goodness towards others. And we're out of time for tonight. How much time do we have here? And so, again, many lives not by bread. Man lives not by bread alone, remember. And I want to wish all of you out there listening tonight the most blessed Thanksgiving. And I want you to think about just how much you have to be thankful for. Joe, do you have a closing comment?
You hit it. We sometimes God blesses us in ways that we don't even see, keeps us from dangers, keeps us from illnesses. He's filled us with love, joy, laughter, and even we're to even bless and thank him for the tribulations that strengthen our faith.
Amen. Randy?
Oh, I'm thankful to be part of this ministry and a witness under God. A chance to love people verbally as well as on my knees and bended knees. Thank you for that, and also for our marvelous listening audience.
Lisa?
And I'd like to praise the Lord, first of all, for my salvation, and also for bringing me here to Ohio, where I have a real pastor, a real church, and a real service together with all these wonderful brothers and sisters in Christ here.
Whit?
Yeah, I'm just thankful also to be here, and I see the many paths my life's taken, and it's brought me here to be a little bit part of this ministry, and I'm just so thankful for all the wonderful people here, and I kind of see God's plan to help us fight the fight and encourage others.
And I'm thankful for all the blessings and all of the letters that we receive from the folks out there that have helped and supported this ministry over all of the years. Again, we could not do what we're doing, and we're going to continue. Because we serve an awesome God, and he reigns from heaven on high with wisdom, power, and loving. And we're going to continue, and I want to encourage all of you out there to remember that the Lord said he would bring the victory, and he will. God will always, always do what he says. He always has, and he always will. And he's told us the times are going to get tough. We're living in now what is called the evil day, and we see the rising of the Antichrist world system. And so right now, he has called you, he's raised you up to stand at this time. Do not let him down. Show him that you're going to run a good race, you're going to fight a good fight. And if you do that, someday you will hear, "Well done, my good and faithful servant." Good night. God bless. Happy Thanksgiving. And keep
fighting the fight.
Thanks for listening to the Voice of the Christian Resistance. What's Right, What's Left. Hosted by Pastor Ernie Sanders. To learn more about our ministry, please visit us online at www.wrwl.org. Please tune in next time for another edition of What's Right, What's Left.
The preceding program is sponsored by What's Right, What's Left Ministries and is responsible for its content.